I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Student debt, which now totals $1.2 trillion, has surpassed credit card debt. The average graduate with a bachelor's degree is almost $30,000 in debt, when with it an advanced degree, even more. President Obama signed an executive order to expand the pay-as-you-earn program yesterday that caps loan repayments at 10% of the borrower's income. Obama said he also supported a student loan plan by Senator Elizabeth Warren that would reduce interest rates for borrowers. We asked Matthew Chingos and Janet Lauren to walk us through these proposals, and to talk about why so many grads have so much debt. Matthew Chingos is a fellow at the Brookings Institution's Brown Center on Education Policy, where his research focuses on online learning and the quality of post-secondary instruction and the student loan debt. And Matthew Chingos, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Janet Lauren. She writes about higher education for Bloomberg News, focusing on college admissions, financial aid, and student debt, part of the Bloomberg team that won the 2012 George Polk Award for National Reporting for a year-long series on student debt. And Janet Lauren, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
Janet, let me put some facts and figures on the table first before we talk about what the president was talking about yesterday. How many people in this country are currently paying off their student loan debt?
Oh, it's millions and millions. And the reason why we're seeing the loan volume increase is because more people are going to college. And as the price goes up every year, families are borrowing more to meet those costs.
And Matthew, what are the sort of range of debt that the graduates and even of bachelor's and higher degrees, what kinds of debt are they having when they leave school?
As you mentioned, the typical debt load for a person with a bachelor's degree is about $30,000. Obviously, there's a big range around that. Plenty of folks don't borrow at all to go to college, either because they go to a low-cost college or because their parents pay for it. Some people borrow a lot more. And where you're really seeing a lot of these big balances, a lot of the shocking numbers that you see in the media, it's driven by people getting graduate degrees, where it's not uncommon to see people with balances in excess of $50,000, not for an undergraduate degree, right, but to get a graduate degree.
Like a law degree or medical degree, something like that?
Or even a master's degree. Janet had a great story come out recently profiling some students who didn't have any debt as undergraduates, but then went and got a master's in, say, urban planning and racked up a good balance.
And, Janet, what's the delinquency rate on these student loans?
The rate that came out last September was about 15%, and that's people who hadn't made their payments in 270 days over the last 3 years. Now, you have to keep in mind, when you're looking at the default rate, it doesn't really tell you the full picture, because students can legitimately be deferring their loans. They can be in forbearance, which means they're struggling. So they're not counted in the number of defaulters. So it doesn't tell you exactly what's happening, because there may be, you know, a lot more borrowers who are having problems making their payments, but they're just not showing up in that default rate.
And Matt, who holds most of these loans? Is it the government? Is it private banks?
Well, the federal government holds the vast majority of these loans. In the past, the loans are backed by the government but made through private banks. Now the government makes all the loans directly.
Let me go back to you, Janet, and talk about what the president offered today. This is an executive order having to do with the pay-as-you-earn program. What did he announce yesterday?
So he announced a couple of things. The most important one for borrowers is that the pay-as-you-earn program, which caps payments at 10% of discretionary income, would be expanded to a new class of borrowers, those who took out loans, I believe it was before 2007, and that would add about 5 million borrowers into the program. And what that means is that, you know, if they're having trouble making those payments, they can pay less every month, and ideally they would have more cash in their pockets every month to spend on other things, and perhaps that could help the economy, help the housing market, because we've been hearing more and more reports lately of this growing economic divergence between those who have student loan debt and those who don't.
And Matt, I would assume if I were like the millions of people with some debt from college, I would want in on that program if what it is I pay 10% of my income to pay back my loan.
Yeah, the program is a great option for people who are struggling to make their student loan payments. I think it's important to point out this isn't going from nothing to this new pay-as-you-earn program. There's already a program called income-based repayment that caps payments at 15% of your monthly income, and these borrowers are already eligible for that program. For what the president has done is made these students eligible for a newer, more generous program that gets them from 15% to 10%.
And is it open to everybody?
Everyone with federal loans, although I think the transition for these older borrowers is just going to be for people with direct loans, which is a particular type of loan made directly by the government as opposed to the older loans that were made through private borrowers. But the regulations haven't come out yet. That'll take over a year to happen, so I'm not sure the details have been completely nailed down.
But, Janet, I was reading that this seems to be programs that are being underutilized. Do I have that right?
Yes. In fact, the department sent out mass communications at the end of last year to tell borrowers that they could be eligible for these types of programs and to look into them. And one complaint that we heard, especially in the Senate committee last week, are the servicers, people who collect payments for these loans, are they letting people know what their options are?
I mean, we are talking about, Janet, I mean, what sounds like a very complicated system. Is that a correct description of what we're talking about?
In fact, there's the pay-as-you-earn and income-based repayment aren't the only types of programs out there. If you're struggling, you can do another program where you could stretch out your payments over 25 years. The woman in my story today took advantage of that program. So it is very confusing, and there's a lot of options, and I believe Senator Rubio had proposed another bill that would sort of streamline all these different types of options, because it is very confusing to borrowers. And keep in mind that, you know, borrowers just don't have one loan for college. They, you know, you take on a new loan every year. Often, you know, they may have different interest rates. They may have a different servicer. If you have a private loan, it's completely different from a federal loan. So you've got to keep track of so many different items that it can be difficult.
And Matt, is this a drag on the economy?
There's certainly a story out there that the amount of student loan debt is a drag on the economy. When you take a closer look at it, the evidence underlying that claim isn't that strong, that there's something about student loan debt in particular that's a drag on the economy. I mean, people having less money as opposed to more money could certainly be seen as a drag on the economy. Mm-hmm. And giving Americans more money by their government through taxpayer-funded programs could be seen as a way to stimulate the economy. But it's not obvious to me that the people that ought to be targeted with stimulus are the people that hold student loan debt. There's lots of other folks out there who could benefit from that money as well.
But if I'm graduating with a bachelor's degree and, let's say, $30,000 in debt, it seems to me that limits my buying power. If I'm thinking about a house, if I'm thinking about a car, all those purchases can get delayed because of a student loan, Matt.
Sure. I mean, so in that case, once again, for that person, if they had more money, they could do more of those things. But think about someone who never went to college, probably makes less money because they didn't go to college, doesn't have student loan debt. They're struggling too. So when we're thinking about, you know, government programs to aid people who are struggling, it's just not obvious to me that we want to somehow start with the people with student loan debt. And I would think about targeting more in terms of who needs the help the most and who's struggling the most. And that would certainly include people with student loan debt who don't make very much money, but it might include people without student loan debt as well.
What do you think about that, Janet?
No, it's a very good point. In fact, the bill that Senator Elizabeth Warren has introduced to allow student loan borrowers to refinance their debt, would certainly help those struggling with student loan payments. But one criticism that many Republicans have is that it doesn't address the problem of increasing costs in college, and it doesn't help students who are going to go to college or who are in college, you know, reduce the cost of that large expense.
But one of the arguments in favor of refinancing is that if you own a house, you can refinance that. I mean, there are other parts of the economy where you can refinance your payment. Why not for college expenses, Matt?
Well, you can refinance your student loans. You can go to a bank, and if there's a bank that's willing to give you a deal that's better than the one you have from the government, you are free to do that, just as you're free to go to a bank and get a better deal on your home loan or your car loan. The fact is, the federal government offers these loans on subsidized terms. So students get a pretty good deal relative to what the market would give them. So that's the reason that it's not that they can't refinance, it's that banks don't want to refinance them because they don't think they can do it and make money.
Do you think Senator Warren's idea is going to go anywhere, Matt?
I think given the politics of it, I don't think it's going to go anywhere, particularly the way it's been tied to this Buffett rule, a tax increase on wealthy households. That's something that I think has been a non-starter for the Republicans, so it's hard to imagine it getting through the Senate, and it's even harder to imagine it getting even taken up by the House.
Do you want to explain that, Janet, the kind of offset if this were to get passed?
It would be a tax on wealthy Americans. Actually, I think Matt did a great job explaining it, and I agree with his assessment.
Well, let me make sure I understand, and our listeners do as well, because it seems that in order to reduce then the percentage of payment, that would what? Then reduce the money that goes to the government, Matthew?
I'm sorry, can you clarify the question? You're asking about the tax increase or about the what Warren wants to do in terms of refinancing loans?
Yeah, she wants to reduce the interest rates for borrowers.
Exactly. So she wants to allow people who took out loans when rates were higher to get the new rates that are now lower. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of just like writing a check to people who have student loans, and the more loans you have, the bigger the check you get. So if you went to a graduate school and took out big loans, you'll probably get a bigger benefit from the Warren proposal mm-hmm. than if you have a smaller balance because you maybe have less education. And that costs something. And the way that she proposes to pay for it is through a tax increase on wealthy households.
And you see the interest rates for some of these loans, especially graduate school loans. They are as high as 8.5%, 7.9%. Parent loans are also that high. In some graduate school loans, we're at 6.8%. So, if you reduce the interest rate, the monthly payment would be reduced.
And obviously, the bigger your monthly payment, the more it would get reduced. Do I have that right, Janet?
Yes. Because you would be paying less interest, just like if you refinanced your house from a higher interest rate to a lower interest rate, your monthly payment would be less.
But Matt, what I hear from you is that you're saying it's really not that onerous, what people are paying now.
I'm not saying that it's not onerous. I'm saying that it's a benefit that'll disproportionately go to wealthier households. So in a previous analysis, I found that the top quarter of households in this country, in terms of their income, hold 40% of the student loan debt. So if we were to give everyone refinancing, it wouldn't be a very progressive policy. It would actually be quite regressive in that wealthier families would get a bigger benefit from the Warren bill. Now, the Warren bill does include a provision that allows the Secretary of Education to limit eligibility for this refinancing program to people based on their income level or on the ratio of their debt to their income. So we actually don't know who will be eligible for this program, whether it'll be widely available or whether it'll be more limited.
Well, we are talking about student debt in this hour, taking a very short break, getting back to our conversation with Matthew Chingos from the Brookings Institution and Janet Lauren, who writes about higher education for Bloomberg News. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The National Museum of American Jewish History at 5th and Market supports WHYY and presents Dreamers and Doers, Kim Ang, on Wednesday, June 11th at 7 p.m., a conversation between the most senior female executive with Major League Baseball and Dave Davies, WHYY senior reporter and guest host of Fresh Air. This program is being held in conjunction with the special exhibition Chasing Dreams, Baseball and Becoming American, currently on view. NMAJH.org or 215-923-3811.
Next time in Studio 360, we go out to the Aspen Ideas Festival for a science lesson.
And so now we're going to perform for you the song, Why Does the Sun Really Shine?
They might be giants. Get their facts straight.
The sun is a miasma of incandescent plasma. The sun's not simply...
Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Charmaine Gibbons-Thomas caused a stir at last week's Walmart stockholders meeting.
Something is wrong when the richest family in America pays hundreds of thousands of associates so little they cannot survive.
She's a Walmart employee and a stockholder. We'll talk with her next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. As we all know, the cost of higher education has increased dramatically in the last few decades. Most graduates leave their college or university owing thousands of dollars. We're talking about the president, the Congress, and their proposals to ease student debt. Talking with Janet Lauren, and you can tweet her at Janet Lauren. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Also talking with Matthew Chingos from Brookings Institution. And you can tweet him at Chingos. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I think the elephant in the room, Janet, is why do colleges cost so much? And I realize they run the gamut if you're talking about a community college or a public college, or even when you get into the more high-priced private colleges. What's the cost driver here?
Very good question. That gets to the heart of why people have to borrow to pay for it. I think you've seen in the last couple of decades, colleges have an arms race against each other. Somebody builds a fabulous building, and their competitors want to, be competitive, so they feel the need to borrow their own money and build new buildings, create new institutes. You'll hear colleges say, well, we need to follow the government regulations. For example, a Title IX coordinator was something colleges pointed to, that they had to follow the federal guidelines and hire new staff. You'll see services are certainly enhanced. You look at career services. When I went to college a long time ago, the office was not so robust as it is today, and certainly students are worried about getting jobs, so they have more layers of some services like that, more administrators, etc.
Do you see it that way, Matt?
I would point to all of those reasons, particularly for competition among the private colleges and universities are competing with these amenities that drive up costs but maybe bear little on the costs of, or rather on the quality of education being provided. Another role that people point to in the public sector is declining public support, that state governments are providing less support to public institutions, so as a result they have to raise their tuition. So I think both of those are important reasons, and I would echo Janet's point, which I think is really important, that this is really what we ought to be talking about. If we're worried about people with student loan debt, we should be talking about the disease, not the symptom, the cost of education, not the debt.
Well, how would you bring down that cost, Matt?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, and I think that's the reason we see Congress and the President focusing on the debt, because it's easy to say, well, let's let people refinance, let's change the interest rate, let's change the way we do the loans, and those things are important to talk about for sure, but those are much easier solutions than how do we deal with what's become a dysfunctional market for higher education, where costs are going up. We're worried that quality hasn't been keeping up with those costs. One solution that I think is important is providing better information. Right now, when people are making a decision about where to go to college, they're looking at things like, does it have a fancy new gym? And maybe they're looking less at measures of the academic quality, because there aren't a lot of measures of academic quality. And one thing a lot of folks think we should know more about are the labor market outcomes of students that go to different colleges. Not that it's all about getting a job and making a good living, but I think if people are going to pay a lot of money for tuition, if they're going to take out loans, they need to have a reasonable assurance that that degree is going to enable them to get a job where they can repay the loan. So it's not that everyone should be an engineer and no one should be an art history major, but if someone's going to take out a loan to be an art history major, they ought to be confident that they won't end up in poverty and unable to pay their loan back.
And Janet, is a college degree still worth the investment of time and money?
Well, we hear study after study that those with college degrees make more money across their lifetime. I think the question is, we had a story last week about young graduates in the jobs they were getting, and we found that 60% of those 22-year-olds who got jobs within 3 years didn't need a BA for the jobs they had. So there seems to be a lot of underemployment. Ideally, hopefully those students end up catching up later. We also included some information about people who graduated college, say, 5 years ago in the worst part of the recovery in 2009, and, you know, they're still struggling. You know, they may not have gotten the jobs that they wanted right away, and maybe it's taken them a couple of years, but, you know, hopefully they catch up and they, you know, they get the wage premium down the line of their increased level of education.
But you're really describing kind of a disconnect between the economy and our education system.
Yes, absolutely.
And I mean, and that would be a big lift in order to try to fix that disconnect.
Well, you know, you have the expectation that you go to college, you're going to get a good job, you go to graduate school, the more education you get, the better pay you're going to get. And, you know, on average, that does work out. But then there are people who it doesn't always work out for. And, you know, you just have to remember that, you know, the law of averages, not everybody's going to see this terrific benefit.
Let me get some callers in. We have, looks like, Derek from Kennett Square joining us on Radio Times. Derek, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for doing this show.
You're welcome.
I actually just graduated on Sunday with an MBA and about $100,000 in student debt.
Wow.
And my question really goes to sort of the way that this is treated tax-wise. I know that there's a student loan interest deduction for your taxes, but that phases out at roughly $75,000 a year. So for people like me and my brother who's in med school, you know, we're going to be earning more than that, but we're also going to have a substantially larger debt load than a lot of individuals that only have undergrad and are going to be able to take advantage of that. So I was wondering if your guests could just sort of speak to it from what the IRS and what the tax code does to benefit us.
Derek, do you have a job?
I do, and I don't want to make my new employer mad. So.
Okay, fair enough. Is it a job that you feel like you got an education for?
Yes, it was a job that definitely came straight through my college. They set me up through the hiring process, and that was actually speaking to what one of your guests said earlier about picking a school that is going to have good employment outcomes. That was definitely what I decided. That was definitely what I chose when I was looking for a graduate program.
Well, congratulations, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Matthew, do you want to take that?
Sure. So I'm not intimately familiar with the details of the tax code around student interest deductions, but the way the caller described it, it sounds like there's a deduction for some of your student loan interest that phases out once you reach a higher level of income. And to me, that seems like a reasonable policy to the extent that you want to, through the tax code, provide some relief to people, some additional subsidy to people paying off their student loans, but not provide it to everyone in order to keep the cost down. So you give it to people with lower incomes and phase it out for higher incomes. Now, the caller is making the point that, well, he'll have a higher income, but he also has a large loan balance. So once again, I think the best way to address those kinds of policy issues is really not through the tax code, but through policies like pay-as-you-earn and income-based repayment that looks at the ratio of your debt to your income and says, well, if you have higher income, we expect you to pay more, right? 10% of $100,000 income is more than 10% of $50,000 income, but we're also going to factor in the level of your debt.
Janet, do you want to add to that?
I don't think I can add more to that.
Let me ask one thing, and I'll put it to you, Janet. As I understand that the pay-as-you-go, that after 10 years, if you're working for a nonprofit, you've essentially paid off your debt, and after 20 years, if you're working in the private industry, your debt is paid off? Again, do I have that right?
You mentioned a couple of different programs. What you're referring to, that after 10 years it goes away, is the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. I believe that's the right name. And that is a program where you would make 120 consecutive payments. Again, this is for federal loans, and then your debt would be erased. And that has not, I believe the first people who would be eligible for that program, it wouldn't be for several years. And the president, if I'm not mistaken, and Matt, you may know some more details, in his budget this year had talked about putting caps on that program. So, you know, it is another option, and it does, you know, encourage people to work for nonprofits or public service. Matt, do I have that right?
Yeah, go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, I think that's a good description of the program. We won't be seeing it coming into effect for a couple more years because, you know, we haven't hit that 10-year mark yet. And you're also right that there are proposals in the president's budget. I can't name them off the top of my head, but that would put some limits on it to try and not make it too generous and, as a result, too costly for taxpayers.
How are civilians, though, supposed to make it through this process? I mean, you two are experts in the student loan program and debt. How are families and their children supposed to understand this stuff? Matt?
You're absolutely right. It's a horribly complicated set of programs. And, you know, I fear the one downside to what the president announced yesterday is that it makes a complicated system even more complicated. The constraint faced by the president and his administration is that they're trying to do what they can without action by Congress. So what really needs to happen here is action by Congress. And what I'd like to see them do is move to one consolidated income-based repayment plan that does protect borrowers from unaffordable monthly payments through some kind of cap based on a percentage of their income, but gets rid of this panoply of programs and just streamlines it and says, here is, you have your standard repayment option and you have an income-based option, and those are the two options, and make them easier to understand, make them more simple programs, and hopefully that'll do something to help not just researchers like us, but also families navigate this process.
And that's Matthew Chingos, who joins us along with Janet Lorne. We are talking about student loans, student debt, and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We have Ryan from North Philadelphia joining us. Ryan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Love the show.
Thank you.
I listen every day while I'm doing therapy in North Philly.
Good for you.
So I'm a physical therapist. I graduated in 2011, and I have an exorbitant amount of student loan debt, type over $200,000.
Wow.
Because of my program switched from a master's to a doctorate. Now, I understand that that's my decision to take the debt on, but the problem is that, you know, I come from a middle-class family. We can only afford so much money. And my thing is, if I didn't want to get this degree and take on all the debt, which is what a lot of my friends did, I feel like that's really just limiting what, like, social mobility. And if for me to take on all that debt without any programs to help me repay it, you know, it's like I can't really do anything.
Well,
you know, I got a mortgage and no house.
Ryan, how much are you paying off every month on this debt?
Well, luckily, I was able to consolidate my federal loans, which is about half of my debt, and that's down to about less than $700 now. Mm. But with my private student loan debt, which I got through the Higher Education Student Assistance Authority of New Jersey, I'm paying over like $1,400.
Oh, my gosh.
And then also the little loans because in between the fall and the spring semesters, when you have to go on your clinical educations, which is paying to work 40 hours a week for free.
Gotcha.
You know, because you're getting the education as a therapist for your license. That's not included in tuition either.
Wow. That's a lot of money, Ryan. And you're a physical therapist? Is that what you do?
Yep. Oh. And, I was forced to get a doctorate because the field changed to where, as of this year, you can't even have a physical therapy program that's not accredited.
I hear you. Well, let me see what Janet Lorne has to say. Janet, that's a lot of money just for someone to pay back.
Yes. Well, have you tried approaching your private lender to see if they might be willing to negotiate a lower rate? You know, often if you have a history of making on-time payments, you know, that's something they might consider.
I have tried that, but that's the problem is, you know, when I got out of school before I consolidated my federal loans, you know, my payment was $2,500 a month. And,
wow.
You know, I was only making less than $4,000 after taxes. So it's, they have consolidation programs, but they always try to steer you to banks. And when I call, like they said, go to Wells Fargo or Chase. And when I called either of those places, they said they don't do that.
Oh, interesting.
Like nobody wants to touch private student loan debt, especially, you know, when I got out of school in the last couple of years.
Well, Ryan, let me see what Matthew Chingos has to say. Matt, does that sound like a familiar story to you?
I mean, I think it's somewhat exceptional in that the number of people with that level of loan debt is very, very small. That doesn't make the problem any less real for folks who actually have that that level of loan debt. So the caller mentioned consolidating, which is already done. One advantage there is when you consolidate your federal loans, you can get a longer period of repayment. So if you think of college as kind of like a house, it's something, or an education rather, it's kind of like a house, it's something you have over a very long period of time that pays off over a long period of time. That can be a justification for paying your student loans off not over 10 years, but over a longer period of time. And then, of course, there's the income-based repayment programs, which are not available for the private loans, but are available for the government loans, and in some cases allow borrowers to repay their loans, with a lower amount each month. But even for some folks with all of those programs, they're still going to struggle. So, I mean, there's also a set of questions here, and obviously this doesn't help the caller after the fact, but there's a set of broader questions about the cost of these programs and whether it should take, $200,000 in loan debt to become a physical therapist. And it's a broader conversation about what kind of higher education policies we want that might enable folks to get the same level of education and training to go into their desired profession, but at a lower cost.
Ryan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and good luck with that as well. But Janet, I mean, could he take advantage of the program that President Obama announced yesterday, the expansion of this pay-as-you-earn program where you pay 10% of your monthly income?
Likely, yes. That program was expanded to include borrowers who took out their loans pre-2007. So depending on when he took out his loan, likely, yes. And, he has that whole menu of options that we talked about before for his federal loans, pay-as-you-earn, the income-based repayment, stretching your payments out over a longer period of time, as Matt mentioned. Perhaps if you stretch it up to 25 years instead of the 10-year standard repayment program, you would have lower monthly payments. But ultimately, in the long run, you would still be paying more in interest on the loan.
Matt, we're almost about a break, about a minute before our second break here. But is there talk in Washington to address the issue of the high cost of tuition for higher education?
There's certainly talk about it, but it's a really hard problem to tackle, so there's been less action. A couple years ago in his State of the Union address, President Obama put colleges on notice and said he's going to try and do things to go after colleges that increase their prices too much. And that's a hard thing to do. The one proposal the Obama administration has put out is a college ratings plan to try and give consumers more information about the quality of colleges they're going to. I'm skeptical that'll have much value without better data, without better information itself. If we just tell people the information that's already there, I think that's not enough, and we need things like labor market outcomes so students can make an informed calculation, going into a program. I mean, take the caller's example,
right?
A physical therapy program. Here's, for this program, the people that went to this program before me, here's what it costs, and here's the kind of jobs they were able to get, and just decide, is that a reasonable calculation? Is that a good enough bet for me to make by taking out a loan?
That's Matthew Chingos, and again, fellow in the Brookings Institution's Brown Center on Education Policy. Also with us, Janet Lauren. She writes about higher education for Bloomberg News, and we are talking about student debt, and we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
On the next Fresh Air, John Waters. His new book, Carsick, is about hitchhiking cross-country. Part of the book is fiction, in which he imagines best-case scenarios, like being picked up by his favorite porn star, and worst-case scenarios, like getting a ride with a killer who has it in for cult film directors like Waters. Then Waters tells the story of what really happened. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The latest border crisis, thousands upon thousands of young kids, many traveling alone.
We're right now in the process of collecting clothing for children from 1 through 17.
The mayor of Nogales, Arizona, on an immigration system overwhelmed by women and children. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Burnaby Volvo in Huntington Valley supports WHYY. Burnaby Volvo's inventory reduction event is going on now and features a variety of new and pre-owned models available for delivery. Full inventory at burnabyvolvo.com, 215-947-6363.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We are talking about student debt, which now totals $1.2 trillion. Most people who graduate from college these days is graduating in debt. Yesterday, President Obama signed an executive order to expand the Pay-As-You-Earn program, and that's a program that caps loan repayments to 10% of the borrower's income. He also said he supported a student loan plan by Senator Elizabeth Warren that would reduce the interest rates for borrowers. Talking about all of this with Janet Lauren and with Matthew Chingos. We have an email from Laura. Do they know if there is a cap on household income to be eligible for the income-based repayment program then or now? Janet, is there a cap?
Of your income, I think, you know, you would have to show, I don't know the details of what the cap would be, but you would have to show that you're struggling, and then your payments would be capped at 10% of your discretionary income. And what they mean by discretionary income is, you know, things that you need to survive,
right?
Food, shelter, clothing, things like that.
But you have to show to some degree that this is a hardship for you to make these payments.
I believe so.
Do you believe so as well, Matt?
That's roughly right. I mean, the government, being the government, has a bureaucratic definition for what that hardship means. And it basically means that if your payments would be lower, if you could cap them at 10% of your income, where your income is your income minus some allowance for those things that Janet mentioned, then you're eligible. So the definition of having what's called a partial financial hardship is that your loan payment would be higher than what you could get under one of these programs.
Let me see.
And you would also need to show that every year to reapply for that, because if your income, you know, you got a better job and your income was very high, then you would not be eligible.
That's absolutely right. I mean, applying for these programs can be difficult, and then, you know, updating the information as your situation changes. So some folks have actually proposed moving towards a more automatic system where everyone gets automatically enrolled in a program like this, and it goes perhaps through the tax withholding system. So basically your employer would just withhold 10% of your income each month to pay off your federal student loans. Now, there's a debate about whether that's the right way to go, but it would solve some of these problems around making it easier for people to participate and making people more aware of it. Because the problem is you have folks out there who don't have big loan balances, who don't have big payments, but they're struggling financially. They don't sign up for one of these programs, and then they are late on their payments or they default, which hurts their credit, when they really, that didn't have to happen to them.
Matt, have you looked at other countries? I mean, it seems like sort of like our healthcare system, we have created the most complicated system of dealing with student debt that's even imaginable. Aren't there other countries where basically the government pays for your college education?
So that's one model. There are also countries that have automatic income-based repayment programs. That's been the model in Australia for quite some time. Where you repay as a percentage of your income until the loan is paid off, and that's the system they have in Australia.
And it works from what you know?
As far as I know, it works reasonably well, but I'm not intimately familiar with the details of some of the international systems.
Let me get to, it looks like Ed from Atlantic City to join our conversation. Ed, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I graduated back in 92 with a master's degree in counseling psychology, specialization in substance abuse counseling. And one of the problems that I've had is that, unfortunately, this field pays very little, and a master's degree doesn't buy you a heck of a lot more income than a bachelor's degree. However, you can't do anything unless you have a master's degree. Or you're very limited with anything other than a master's degree. Now, I'm still paying off my student loan, and every time I call to ask, you know, what are my options, I'm told, well, you graduated long ago, and therefore a lot of these programs are not available to you.
Can I ask you a question, Ed? How much money are you making with a master's in counseling?
About $35,000 a year.
About $35,000. And how much in loans do you have?
Well, my loans are not exorbitant right now, but they still are, you know, eating into, when you make $35,000, any amount of money coming out of that income is not, you know, has
every penny counts.
You know, every penny counts.
Yeah.
And I know that even when they announced the program, it's working for a nonprofit, which I've been working for a nonprofit for pretty much 22 years since I graduated, you know, I was told, oh, well, you know, that you graduated in 92, and therefore you are not,
right,
these programs don't apply to you.
You know what, Ed, we're beginning to lose you on your phone, but let me see if Janet Lauren can help out. Here's someone graduated 92, making $35,000 a year working for a nonprofit, and has some student loans. Does he have options that he doesn't know of?
You know what the president announced yesterday, since it applies to borrowers before 2007, might be an option. That certainly would be something to look into. Another idea is,
yeah, go ahead.
It would never hurt to call the school where you went and ask to talk to the financial aid office and say, do you have any ideas for me? Because those folks in the financial aid office are very knowledgeable about things, and they may have an idea that you would never have thought of.
And this, we're talking 22 years of paying off a loan, Matt.
Yeah, it's a long period of time.
Yeah.
So there are some programs that cover older loans, something called income contingent repayment, income sensitive repayment. So it'd definitely be worth going, either calling up or going to the Education Department website, learning more about that. I'm not sure that yesterday's, I read that yesterday's change may only impact direct loans, which are a newer kind of loan. Maybe you can consolidate into that. So as we've sort of agreed on, this is a complicated area. But once again, I think that Ed's story raises a kind of broader set of questions about whether a master's degree that doesn't provide a big bump in income but is kind of a necessary credential, whether it should cost that much, and also broader questions about how we as a society value important but not well-compensated professions like substance abuse counselors. So I think it raises questions that are broader than just the loan debate.
Well, Ed, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and good luck to you as well. We have an email from Irene. What about alternatives such as volunteerism or working in nonprofits in return for reducing student loans? Matt, is that an option for some people?
It's
like service in a way. I mean, instead of paying back, you say I'm gonna work in an inner city school for 3 years, and that will pay back my loan, for instance.
I mean, so we do have a program that we talked about earlier that's sort of like that, called the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, where after 10 years of working in the nonprofit or the public sector, any remaining balance after making those, you know, either 10 or 15% payments, that remaining balance would be forgiven. Now, that, I think it's sort of a strange way to go about that, because you have to be at it for 10 years. So it's, well, if you do it for 8 years,
right,
it's not valued at all by society, but 10 years you get everything back. So that program could be, I think, better designed. And it's also not obvious to me that we want to be subsidizing people in certain sectors of the economy through the loan program. We may decide that as a society, we want to do more to encourage people to go into things like substance abuse treatment, working in inner-city public schools. But I'm not sure we want to only target people who have a certain amount of student loan debt. We may want to just get everyone, right? If we think a certain sector of the economy is important and underpaid, perhaps we ought to have a tax credit or some other kind of subsidy to them, and not do it through the loan programs, which would get some people, including some people who really need the help, but maybe some other people as well.
Let me get, looks like Brian from Germantown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Brian. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
Good morning. You know, I have a son who graduated with $70,000 worth of debt. And he waited for forbearance, and the interest rates scored in a group on his loans. He just joined the military. And I was trying to call Sallie Mae to see if they can work with us to get his loans stop payment on his loans and see if we can pay interest. And they would never work with us. His loans are now up to $100,000. I want to know, does this program cover private loans from, like, Sallie Mae? One more thing. With Matthew. He said we have to have these conversations, but what people need is a relief. Those bills, those 10% bills that in Congress, you should support these things. It doesn't matter if they don't cover all the segments that we talk about. People need relief from these loans because these loans are, it's economic slavery. It's enslaving our society. I know many young people who just stopped paying these loans because the interest rates are so high, they don't make enough money, and the loan companies are not working with them. Right now I'm in the process of refinancing my house to pay off this loan. And it's ridiculous what we have to do. $100,000 for a bachelor's degree.
Yeah, I know. I hear you. I hear you, Brian. I appreciate the call, and let me toss that first to you, Matthew.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that $100,000 in debt for a bachelor's degree is crazy, and unfortunately, private loans are not eligible for these income-based repayment programs. Now, the individual banks that make the private loans may have some of their own programs, but the programs we've been talking about today on the show would not apply. So, I don't doubt that there are folks who are struggling out there, and to the extent that we can provide relief, I think we just have to think about the cost of doing that. So acknowledging the fact that public resources are fixed are always limited, and you have to make decisions about who to help and who not to help. So the thing that I like about the income-based repayment programs are that they help protect people from unaffordable monthly payments during times when their income is low relative to the amount of debt they have, and then as their income increases, they're expected to pay more. But it's not obvious to me what we ought to do about people with large amounts of private loans. There's people with large amounts of all types of loans who I don't doubt are struggling, and it's not obvious to me that the government just ought to go and pay it off for them, because that would create what are called moral hazard problems, where you start out by helping people who maybe didn't make a mistake, they just got unlucky, but then once people say, oh, wait a minute, I take out a big debt and I don't have to pay it off in the end, that can create some real issues down the road.
Janet, he mentioned Sallie Mae. We don't have all the details, but anything you want to toss in about Sallie Mae?
Well, Sallie Mae used to originate government loans. They no longer do that because the government cut them out, and now we have what's called direct lending starting as of 2010. Sallie Mae recently split into two companies. One is a lender, and one is a servicer called Navient. You heard the president yesterday talk about renegotiating contracts with the servicing arm of Sallie Mae because people have complained about the customer service. Are they letting them know about all the income-based repayments? So there's a little bit more context about Sallie Mae.
We have a tweet from Rob. Are there websites I can check out to find out more about programs to reduce payment? Are there some good websites that you've used, Janet, for instance?
Go to Student Aid, the website there, Federal Student Aid. That tells you, it's the government's website, and that will tell you everything you need to know.
Student
about
Aid.
These different types of programs.
Excellent. Let me get Cecilia from Chestnut Hill to join our conversation. Cecilia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
I would like to address two things, one of which is FAFSA and how I have three children who went to college. And, when you do your application, the federal government will say you are capable of paying this amount of money, which is exorbitant considering that a middle-class family has limited income. Then what happens is that based on that, you get your financial award, and the federal government will then offer you a limited amount of money. For my children, it was very small. The next option is to go to the private loan system.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is they are now saddled with all this debt. And I remember back in the 70s, what people were doing is they ended up getting so crushed by debt that they were filing for bankruptcy. And then the option for cleaning your debt, educational debt, by way of bankruptcy went away. And yet I've worked for corporations who apply for bankruptcy over and over and over again so that these companies can then recontribute back into the economy. And I know bankruptcy...
Well, you know, Cecilia, I got to stop you there. And I appreciate...
Thank you.
You made your point. I think it's an interesting one. And I'm jumping in only because we have a minute before we have to say goodbye. Matthew, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, the bankruptcy thing is something folks in Washington are talking about. The concern is that it's not impossible, but it's very, very difficult to have your student loans discharged during bankruptcy. The idea is that you don't give up the education. Perhaps it could still enable you to make more money after you emerge from bankruptcy. But at the same time, there are clearly cases of people who have exorbitant amounts of debt who do need to get out from under it. So I think there is agreement among some folks about changing that standard, not to make it extremely easy to get rid of education debt in bankruptcy, but to have some kind of middle ground where it's easier than it is now to discharge your student loan debt during bankruptcy.
And Janet, again, we're almost out of time. Elizabeth Warren's bill, do you think it has any chance of surviving through Congress? Do we have Janet? We seem to have lost Janet. We're going to end on that very quiet end to Radio Times. Well, Matthew Chingos, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Sorry about that weird ending there. He's a fellow in the Brookings Institution's Brown Center on Education Policy. And we were talking with Janet Lauren. She writes about higher education for Bloomberg News. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. And you can find out much more about this program, including podcasts and Twitter, Facebook, email, archives, satellite radio, and how to get our weekly newsletter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.